as rock, but hey, there's a few of us out there in media, would be on a mainstream outlet if we could get some enlightened programmers who connect the dots. I've been doing it for more than 10 years, let's say 15 years, and DR woke up and has been connecting the dots since he actually read the IPCC report in 2007. And as I mentioned, been doing this green beat for years, and one of the few guests I've not had on that I've wanted to is our guest today. And I'm very pleased and honored that Dr. Jeffrey Sachs is taking time out of his very busy schedule. He is an American economist. He's also the director of the Earth Institute at Columbia University. There is oh so much to talk about in terms of what climate change is doing in terms of extreme weather impacts and how we're seeing it. Almost can't keep up with all of the devastation. So perfect day to have you on. Thanks so much, Dr. Sachs, for joining us. You there?
Well,
hello.
I'm here.
Okay. The studio said we had him, so I will assume there's just a temporary glitch. Oh, he's running a little bit behind. That's okay. We have plenty to talk about. In fact, DR, since you were kind enough to set up today's show, getting both Dr. Sachs and our second guest lined up, tell us a little bit about what we can expect in the second half in terms of is the Republican Party actually anti-science?
Yeah, there was a great piece by Sean McElwee in Salon.com responding to a piece in The Atlantic by a gentleman named Misha Fisher, who was, I guess, a former House GOP staffer who tried to deny that the GOP has anti-science tendencies. And Sean McElwee provided a necessary correction and pointed out that, yes, there are, you know, the Republican Party has given itself over to an anti-science mentality.
Hmm. And have you followed Sean's work? Do you know where he stands politically, or is he an independent journalist?
Well, he's working for the Demos think tank, which is a progressive think tank, and Bob Herbert, the former New York Times columnist, works for that organization. So he's a great writer and a very spirited thinker, and definitely enjoy reading him.
Hmm. Last week we talked about the devastation that hit the Philippines. I heard one newscaster say they're just starting to recover. They haven't recovered yet, or something ridiculous like that. Yeah, like this is life-changing, country-changing. People have lost family members, entire families, homes, jobs, schools. I mean, what do you notice? What I notice is that with each and every one of these recent weather disasters, not only does the background look like it's been hit by, you know, a nuclear bomb or a wrecking ball or with buildings and other, you know, infrastructure just splintered, for lack of a better word, everyone's talking about how they've never seen anything like this. And then, sure enough, over the weekend, on Sunday, we saw our own country, a big swath of the Midwest, getting hit, literally tornadoes touching down in Peoria. So will it play in Peoria climate change awareness? We'll see. But the dots have to be connected, perhaps not quite yet, but in the coming weeks and months, people better start talking about what is, if not causing, these destructive storms, tornadoes, hurricanes, typhoons, then what's making them worse, which, of course, is all the emissions we're pouring into the atmosphere. I think we have Dr. Jeffrey Sachs on with us now.
Yes, we do.
Hey, thanks for being with us. You missed the introduction. We thought you had you a few minutes ago. I just want to thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule. I did try you once about 5 years ago when I was doing a show, Eco Talk, on Air America. I'm sure you don't remember that, but I do. And every time I see you, I say, got to get him on the show. So I want to thank my co-host, D.R. Tucker, for reaching out to you at this very critical time in terms of hopefully our awakening in this country in terms of how we do, in fact, connect the dots between these, weather disasters and the enormity and magnitude of the destruction, devastation, and death from the Philippines to Washington, Illinois, to start to look at, you know, why are we seeing these record-breaking storms?
Well, we're changing the climate, as you've been saying, and we're seeing extremes of all sorts all over the world with increasing frequency. We are seeing more flooding, more droughts, stronger high-intensity cyclones, hurricanes in our part of the world, and similar storms in other parts of the world. Now, for any particular storm, as is well known, one can't say that's because of climate change, but what one can say is that the frequency of these catastrophes is rising, and what one can certainly say is that the risks are increasing dramatically in the future, and that's what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change just reported in September, that for a very long list of risks, we are seeing a rising danger now and in the future.
It's a very good point, and once again, thank you, Dr. Sachs, for joining us. What do you make of the argument that's been made most famously by Kevin Trenberth, the National Center for Atmospheric Research, that all of these recent extreme weather events are influenced by climate change simply as a consequence of the amount of carbon that's been pumped into the atmosphere?
Well, I think, again, for any particular event, one can't guarantee that it wouldn't have happened before we had such a large carbon dioxide loading in the atmosphere. We had extreme storms, and that's what the climate skeptics or deniers say. And they're right that you can't say that a particular storm is the result of the human actions. But what one can say is that we're making the world awfully dangerous. The number of dramatic heat waves, the high-intensity hurricanes in our part of the world, the flooding, the rising sea levels, the acidification of the oceans, these are trends that are very, very dangerous. We're already seeing the consequences of them, but when the science is asked to look forward at what it will mean when we're not at 400 parts per million CO2, but 430 parts per million, 450 parts per million, then the dangers multiply and the risks become even greater than they are right now. We're absolutely being reckless. And what the climate deniers or skeptics, as they prefer to be called, are saying is wait until the world is definitively ruined before you take action, because maybe you'll do something that is preventing something that isn't there. We can't be 100% sure. And what they're not looking at is the risks of inaction, that when all the evidence is pointing to the destabilization of the climate and the threats to humanity, that we should just sit there until they're convinced to the fifth decimal point. It's absurd. And I've now seen it in the last few days. What they seem to specialize in is, oh, you didn't explain this little twist of the curve, but what they don't do is look at the giant change of the curve. In this case, for example, the temperature trends of the last century, which have been showing a dramatic rise of the Earth's warming. And they say, oh, yes, but what about the last 2 years? That kind of thing. And all of this is either a cynical game, which it is when it's played by people like David Koch or Rupert Murdoch, or it's a matter of confusion, or it's a matter that people don't want to believe it because it would somehow violate their sacred libertarian views. They don't want the government to do anything. Climate change requires government action. Therefore, climate change can't be true. That's the illogic that is at play.
So it's ideology over survival of the human race and all other living creatures over the long haul.
You see it because it's strange. Political ideology, in this case, very free market libertarianism, is driving scientific attitudes. No, it can't be true, because if it were true, I might have to change political ideology, they're saying. And so it's what's called cognitive dissonance. They don't want to believe something that would violate their other point of view. And in this case, their point of view is mainly a political point of view, and so they don't want to believe the science.
I was just this morning looking over some of my appearances on Fox TV, can't call it Fox News, with Sean Hannity and the famous climate denier Chris Horner, and they were talking about the cognitive dissonance that we earthers must be having when there's a major blizzard, a snowstorm, and we call it global warming. And I said, no, actually, cognitive dissonance is what you guys feel. You can't handle the fact that science is proving you wrong.
Exactly.
I mean, And that was about 2.5 years ago, by the way. That was, yeah, coming up on 2 years. It was just after Christmas, 2011. And they're still getting away with it, Dr. Sachs. I know it's DR's turn for a question, and we have so much to ask you about. It's great to have you. I just want to ask you if you've been following what's going on in Warsaw with the climate conference, and you use the word maddening. It is most maddening, and it's also madness, as the climate envoy from the Philippines very dramatically, movingly said at the opening of the conference.
The conference is, at best, a stepping stone to an agreement in 2015. So nobody should expect a decisive breakthrough right now. We're on a timetable, too slow, but it is a timetable, to reach a new climate agreement in November 2015, the so-called COP21. This is COP19, the Conference of the Parties, 19th meeting since 1994. And it is in Paris in November 2015 that the full new treaty is supposed to be agreed. Now, this doesn't mean that they have nothing to do between now and then. They're supposed to be drafting parts of this new frameworks. It's a pretty complicated undertaking. But there's seething frustration on many fronts. Of course, the Philippine delegate was so impassioned with the destruction of his homeland on the same day that the conference was opening. He brought the reality into the hall in Warsaw. But at the same time, the U.S. Negotiator, Todd Stern, basically threw a kind of stink bomb saying, climate financing, don't count on it. Any money from rich countries, don't count on it. Any help for the poor countries, don't count on it. I'm paraphrasing, but the fact of the matter is that there are really different points of view. Countries that are poor and that essentially are on the receiving end of these shocks, the rising sea levels, the parts of their countries going underwater, the more extreme storms, the heat waves, and so forth, look to the rest of the world and say, you caused this, you promised to help us, and now you tell us nothing. And this is another part of the grim reality of the politics. Here we have the deniers, the mess, the Congress that is in the hands of the oil lobby. Internationally, you have dozens of countries around the world that are just stupefied at the unwillingness of the United States to follow through on its part of a promise to raise $100 billion a year to help poor countries face the climate change crisis. And I do expect the U.S. to live up to that. And so far, of course, it's not the case. It's understandably not the case in one sense, because we can't even get our political system to open eyes to problems that are directly hitting the United States. But we do have a responsibility globally as well, since the United States bears the largest historical responsibility for the buildup of the greenhouse gases.
You mentioned the point about people not wanting to give up their ideology even in the face of a crisis. And I think this is most demonstrated in the November 18th piece by Robert Samuelson in the Washington Post, where he basically wrote this column saying, well, you know, I don't think the risks are going to be as severe as all the scientists say it's going to be, but just on the off chance, let's have a federal carbon tax. Do you think that it's going to get to the point where, you know, as we look at more extreme weather events, particularly hitting the United States, individuals in Congress, particularly in the Republican Party, will be in a position where just to prevent independent voters turning against them in the places where they are vulnerable, they'll be forced to embrace some of the market-based ideas to reduce carbon emissions, such as the carbon tax? In other words, at what point does the denial become a political liability for Republicans?
I think it's going to happen. Right now, the truth is that the majority of Americans, quite a large majority, something around two-thirds, say that climate change is a reality. Of those that do, roughly two-thirds of those say that it is human-induced. We have, in other words, strong consensus. In this country, people will you know, some people will agree with almost anything, but we have a pretty strong consensus that climate change is underway and that it's caused by human actions. We also have a strong public sentiment, which has been consistently expressed for many, many years, that we should be investing in alternative forms of energy like wind and solar power rather than new fossil fuel energy. And that showed up again in a recent Pew survey. So I think that the politics is ripe for something new. Of course, in the United States, our political system doesn't mainly aggregate opinion these days or aggregate votes. It aggregates money. And the money has been speaking very loud. The oil industry, of course, the Koch brothers most famously, but it's more general than that, pay for the Congress that we have. And this is the real problem, in my view, not convincing the public, but overcoming the money crisis. And I think we have to help people to understand why it is that Americans with common sense, with decency, with good values, with wanting to protect our country from all of the damage that's already happening, are on one side, and the interest groups of oil, coal, and gas are on the other side. This is, I think, the most important next step, actually. It's not fighting with the climate deniers or skeptics, so-called. I found that they have no alternative to offer. They just try to nitpick here and there, but they don't have any alternative theory. They just say, oh, that's natural, but they don't have any mechanisms, explanation, physics, science on their side. So there's not too much to really argue about. What I do think the American people would like to know is that most Americans are on the side of doing something and doing something sensible. But that is important news that is not well understood. And what certainly is not well enough understood is the hammerlock of the fossil fuel sector on the American Congress. And I think when that starts to break, we're going to have a very different kind of politics. I'm sorry to say, very sorry to say, believe me, I don't want to be misunderstood, but we're going to have more climate catastrophes in this country. We had terrible flooding of Superstorm Sandy last year. We had massive drought over more than 50% of the country. We had the hottest year on record for the lower 48 states in 2012. The American people know something dangerous is happening, and it's a danger that's hitting all parts of this country. So I think that when those terrible shocks come, no one can wish them, that's for sure, because they are going to cause damage. They will claim lives, but they are going to come because that's the world that is taking shape right now. Politics is going to change. The money interests are going to be overcome, and we're finally going to get on to some sense, because at the end of the day, the American people want to protect their children, and they're not doing it right now, or Congress isn't doing it on their behalf, let me put it that way.
Boy, it could go in so many different directions. We focus here a lot on how the mainstream media covers or does or fails to cover climate and ocean crises, and you name it, across the board, and been watching very closely as they cover the Philippines. CNN's done an excellent job of having Anderson Cooper there, really bringing the tragedy, you know, into American homes. And I've never seen, and I'm sure you would agree, anything this sad in terms of mothers standing there with their dead children who haven't been picked up yet 3 days after the typhoon. People just lost everything. And it's sad enough, and it's bad enough to see what has been wrought, but when people call this a natural disaster or curse Mother Nature or even think it's God's will, if we know too much, as those of us who have followed this story unfold do, meaning that we are partially responsible for this because we have not curbed our emissions, it's that much more profoundly sad and tragic. And those of us who have been trying to get some mainstream media coverage on a regular basis feel even more determined and I suppose you could say angry, to try to get them to see that this at least deserves a mention when they're covering the devastation, and yet they're not. connecting it to climate change still. Maybe a mention, but don't we need a place that's dedicated to really talk about the myriad challenges we face, urgency, getting that across, and also to talk about solutions, as we do here on this show. And, you know, the scientists are trying to get word out, and the public seems to care, but they want to know what do we do, what's next, and that's where I think media really could play a pivotal role here. I wonder if you agree.
Well, I think that the worst of it is that our leading business newspaper, the Wall Street Journal, is deliberately, recklessly, flagrantly peddling garbage on this issue because it is basically a mouthpiece for the oil lobby. And they simply hide behind their very good news reporting to have an editorial page which is completely irresponsible on this issue, and relentlessly so, and one that will not open up for discussion. I've tried for many, many years. They're just in their fortress of denial. And, of course, Fox, as you say, doesn't even pretend at news, and it spews out this nonsense as well. And, unfortunately, a lot of business readers read The Wall Street Journal. It's understandable. I read The Wall Street Journal also for the business news. And then they read the editorials, and they regard them as other than what they are. They're kind of science fiction, light fiction reading, very annoying, sometimes unbelievably so. But unfortunately, a lot of business people take this for real, and that's the tragedy. So we need to find ways that people can get the right information use that information to not only have themselves informed, but to be able to play the role of an informed citizenry demanding action on this. Now, again, as I said earlier, it is, despite all of that, still the case that most Americans have it right. That's good news. It's our politicians that we really need to follow up on. We have flagrantly anti-scientific congressmen in key positions, but they're not even interested. They're playing a game. They know where their campaign contributions are coming from, and this is what we absolutely need to break, and I think it's going to take not only media but real politics here. It's going to take a massive effort of fighting these people in the elections convincing the American people once again that they have the power to overcome the special interests.
Hmm. Speaking of the politics, what is your take on President Obama's actions over the course of this year and also over the course of his administration to address climate change? We all remember that great speech he did back in June at Georgetown, and a mutual friend of ours says that they wish that President Obama had delivered that speech in prime time as a sort of a state of the climate address to sort of rally people to action. Has Obama done overall a good or fair or a poor job in your view?
The problem of modern politics is that you're in the hands of your political advisors, and the political advisors have no interest in the substance. Their job ostensibly is to get you reelected, and I find them completely infuriating, by the way. I just think it's a terrible, terrible occupation, I'm sorry to say, because it's all spin and no substance, and they played that role in the Obama administration in the first term. There was one attempt at doing something on climate, a very, very cumbersome, flawed, not very clever, sprawling piece of legislation that never got very far. There were much better things that should have been done and could have been done, but the fact of the matter is very little effort was put into it, and there are some powerful accounts how the political advisors basically shut up Stephen Chu, who was the energy secretary, Nobel laureate, obviously on top of all of the science, just the kind of person that one wants in office. But we didn't hear from him basically for 4 years, and that's because the White House locked him in the cabinet, as they say.
Jones got there as Green Jobs are, and Glenn Beck somehow managed to get him fired. Just when we have somebody who gets it, they're in a position of power, you know, with the ear of the president.
Yeah, I have supported this White House, and I've voted for President Obama twice, of course, but I can't really, and I very much applaud the attempt to move EPA regulations forward on coal-fired power plants. But this is not commensurate with the complexity, with the urgency, with the deeper nature of this challenge. Not at all. And so I can't give the administration high marks. You can only give it high marks in comparison with the complete disgusting recklessness of the other side. Flagrant cynicism of the other side, but we're not getting anywhere. Let's face it. When the administration's energy policy is all of the above is not going to save the planet. What would save the planet is a directed program to decarbonize our energy system in the next 30 years. That's what we need, and that could be done with our science. Here we're all remembering President Kennedy, because of the 50th anniversary of his assassination coming up in a couple of days. And President Kennedy put America on the race to the moon and did it right and inspired the country to take on that great challenge. And he did it using these very famous words that I love so much when he said, "We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard, because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one that we are willing to accept, one we are unwilling to postpone, and one which we intend to win." Well, what about a president going before the American people and saying, "We take up the challenge to lead the world in the race to a low-carbon energy system, one that will save the planet, because that will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills, because that challenge is one we are willing to accept." That's what we want to hear from a president. We want to hear that kind of vision and leadership, and we're yearning to hear it. We are going to demand it because the situation is going to demand it. But the damn thing about this climate problem, to put it bluntly, is that we're going to have a nearly irreversible situation by the time we act if we don't pick up the pace, because we're pumping CO2 into the atmosphere. We're pumping the greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We will wake up. The question is when and how far down the road of danger will we be by the time we change. That's why we have to hurry.
Absolutely. And the only thing crazier, and I know it's DR's turn, and then we'll have to close out in a couple minutes, but, you know, if you look on what is on television, what is on radio, mainstream broadcast, it's crazy. Storage Wars and all these other nutty shows. And yet, you know, I have gone to, you know, media programmers, syndicators, and they just, "Oh, we can't do anything on green issues. It's too political. It's advocacy." It's like this somehow has not risen above, you know, the view of legislators, media gatekeepers. They see it as just another issue. And up until very recently, it was last on the issues of concerns for Americans, unfortunately. But it's partly because mainstream media, news media, don't make it such a priority.
The media can make a very big difference. These terrible blows that are hitting the world and that will hit the U.S. again will bring it to attention, and leadership can make a huge difference, too.
But will it be too late? That's the question. They're talking about a 6 to 7 degree warming this century. That's the latest I saw. 6.7 degrees is what's anticipated.
Don't even think about it, because the consequences of that would be so dire. that we don't want to think about the dangers of living in that kind of world, so we have to act sooner than that.
Could not agree more. DR, last question.
Well, not so much a question, but just a comment. Just wanted to thank you again for your great leadership on this. Betsy and I were so thrilled when, in your November the 12th appearance on MSNBC, you basically stated plainly that this is a human-caused problem and that there are interests blocking a solution. And, you know, for those of us who love seeing opportunities to break the climate silence, it was just a thrilling moment. So thank you so much for doing that.
Well, let's keep doing it together because the American people want to know the truth. They're listening. Their eyes are open. We got to get the news to them. And together we got to get the news to Washington even harder, but we'll do it.
And I don't know if you saw, Dr. Sachs, but Jane Velez-Mitchell really got us excited because she's on HLN, usually covers crime. But as DR said, she was talking about the crime of the century, which is climate change and how we are contributing, we humans, to the horrific situation that we've seen in, you know, across the world, really, and Sandy to Peoria with the Philippines, the biggest one in the middle there, and the graphic said unleashed, and she was just, you know, outraged that, you know, we are causing this and we're not doing enough about it. So I think we're going to contact Headline News next and see if they might be interested in the show that talks about what the heck we can do about these many, many looming freight trains coming at us that we are, you know, in a position to either ignore at our own peril and certainly our children's peril, or wake up and smell the carbon, as we say. So thank
very
you.
Good. Well, keep doing it. You're making a huge difference and a great
and
contribution.
Thank you, and I hope you are teaching a lot of upcoming brilliant students at Columbia all the wisdom that you just shared with us today, because we need the next generation to take this on big time. But I maintain we need to help a little bit before we turn over the shovel. We'll get some of the dirt off the hill because we, you know, are going to live to 100. We baby boomers, and so we can't just go to sleep and let the kids take care of it.
You got it.
Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot. Great to be with you.
And we have to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue with our interesting discussion. I'll be checking in with writer Sean McElwee. He talks about how the Republicans really are the anti-science party. He can prove it definitively. Stay tuned for that. We'll be right back.